Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the true value of law school in the 21st century? While many ambitious young Americans continue to aspire to legal careers, a degree from an accredited law school is no guarantee of financial success these days, or even of a job in the profession. That has not prevented steep hikes in many law schools' tuition rates, so that many students graduate with six-figure student loans to pay off out of their mid-five-figure annual salaries. So why have things turned out this way, and what would it take for law schools to remake themselves to better serve their students' real needs? Author Brian Z. Tamanaha is William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law. His new book is called Failing Law Schools. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Clearly, this book will not make you any new friends among your law school colleagues. Talk about why you decided it really had to be written.
Well, I've been concerned for years now about the rising tuition and began writing about it in 2006 in a series of blog posts on a blog, balkanization group blog that I blog on. But in 2008, the legal market suffered a severe recession. And that brought everything to the surface in a way that could no longer be ignored. As you stated in the introduction, the cost of a law degree today is far out of proportion to the economic return, and it's a very risky proposition to go to law school today. And I wanted to detail the economics of attending legal education, not just from the standpoint of students, but also from law schools, why we cost so much, how we've gotten into this position. And as you suggested, it's not entirely popular, but it had to be done.
So how does the number of law graduates in the U.S. in recent years, and you mentioned this sort of crisis in 2008, how does that match up with the number of available jobs for starting lawyers?
Let me give you a stark statistic that was recently released by the ABA, the American Bar Association, which compiles statistics provided by the law schools. For the class of 2011, 9 months after graduation, only 55% of graduates had obtained full-time jobs as lawyers. So that's a shocking number. What I discovered when doing the research for the book is that we've actually had a substantial oversupply of law graduates to available position that goes back at least to 2001. I couldn't go earlier because they changed the method of compiling the statistics. But the oversupply regularly ranged to somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35%. Of graduates each year were not obtaining jobs as lawyers. Now, not everyone who goes to law school becomes a lawyer, but over 90% of the law graduates take the bar, which is an investment of time and money that indicates at least a desire to be eligible to practice law. So these are not people voluntarily choosing to do other things. Now, the legal recession that hit in 2008 and 2009 made it much worse, and there's no indication of things getting any better. And let me add one other statistic. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects openings going forward up to 2018 of about ranging from 26,000 to 28,000 a year. And I'm using the most generous estimate. And law schools have been graduating about more than 40,000 students a year.
So this is a capitalist economy. Typically, when the supply starts to outstrip demand for a while, obviously the cost of that labor goes down. But eventually, one would think that the supply would dry up. Why are law schools not admitting fewer students, knowing that they can't honestly send these young folks out into the world confident they'll find work?
Well, it's even worse than that. When the recession hit, law schools actually admitted more students. Unfortunately, and that's because often in a general economic recession, people turn to law school as a way of retooling either people who are laid off or new college graduates who can't find jobs, in the belief that investing 3 years in a law degree will give them a different set of job opportunities. And law schools initially took advantage of that. What drives the applications to law school are the willingness and the ability to pay. And there's a general belief, I think, that a law degree pays off, and that drives the willingness to come, and the ability to come is funded by the federal loan system, which essentially provides the full cost of attendance to law school. I should make one important correction, and that is for the last 2 years, that is for the class of 2011 and 2000, and now the current class, actually beginning today at many law schools, the number of applicants is down nationwide about 25% from our peak in 2010, so our recent peak. So things are turning around, and I think one reason for this is that in 2011, there was a lot of public news about the riskiness of attending law school today, and I think that message is getting through.
So let's talk about how the federal student loan system plays into lawyers getting themselves into a great deal of debt. There is no limit to how much the size of a loan one can take out in order to cover law school tuition?
That's right. Previously, the government guaranteed private loans. So private lenders made the loans, and then the federal government guaranteed the loans in case of default. In 2009, the private lenders were taken out of the loan business, and the government started lending money directly to graduate students. It's called the Graduate Plus Program. So there are two basic programs that law students rely upon. That's the Stafford Program, which already existed, and the Graduate Plus Program. And the Graduate Plus Program in particular, the Stafford Program has limits, but the Graduate Plus Program does not. Now, these programs are actually very high-interest programs. Stafford is 6.8%, Graduate Plus is 7.9%, which are above market rates. But they're above market because the government expects a certain amount of defaults. And in addition, the loans have more flexibility in them. You can enter a program called income-based repayment, for example, if you don't earn enough to pay off. In any event, the way the government... the Graduate Plus program works is that the loans are actually run through the law school. A student comes into the financial aid office, fills out a one-page form, applies for whatever loan amount, including full tuition and full living expenses that student thinks is necessary. Then the school processes the loan and the money sent to the law school. And this is how, what I describe in the book as the students becoming essentially conduits for obtaining federal money. And then the living expense money is then distributed to the students. Now, what's shocking about this system that I wasn't aware of until I looked into it is that there's no evaluation made at all of the likelihood of repayment. So, for example, a student who goes to a bottom-ranked law school in which 75% of the graduates are not getting jobs as lawyers is treated exactly the same way as a student who goes, for example, to the University of Texas, where most of the students are getting jobs. So there are no economic signals operating in this system that ordinarily, going back to what you said, would inhibit someone financing this scheme, simply because it's the money's given, no questions asked.
Well, of course, some of the success people have in law school has to do with their individual talent and how much work they put in. But talk, if you would, about the marketing of law schools to prospective students and the kind of data that schools tout with regard to employment of their most recent graduates and the salaries those grads are earning.
Right. As I said, one of the factors keeping the number of applicants high relative to the number of jobs is willingness to come. And part of that willingness is just the general belief that a law degree is worthwhile. But it's more than that, and in fact, law schools have for years now been misrepresenting their employment statistics through a number of different devices. So, for example, in the past few years, most law schools have advertised 98% employment rates. A number of law schools have advertised 100% employment rates. Only just this past year are these numbers beginning to come down because of the public outcry over this. And what law schools have been doing is counting as employed anyone who has any kind of job, not a lawyer job. So when they send surveys to graduates after graduation, are you employed? And the student says, yes, I'm employed working in Starbucks or as a clerk at a market, those students were marked down as employed. Now, this is technically complying with the rules, but it's not in the spirit of the rules, because when these employment rates are advertised, naturally prospective students who look at these statistics believe that this is legal employment. In addition to artificially boosting the rate of employment, law schools have also advertised triple-figure salaries when, in fact, the reality was much worse. And we've been doing this in a number of different ways. Now, I should say these were all truthful, at least as far as I know they were truthful. It's just a question of what you count and how you count and how you describe it. And law schools have used a number of techniques to boost the salaries artificially. Just to give you an example, they would describe the category in a particular way that an unwary student wouldn't realize didn't apply to very many students. So one category would be private full-time law firm employment. And often that number, or at many law schools, that number would be, say, $140,000, $135,000, $160,000. But in reality, at many law schools, less than a quarter of the class obtain these positions. And even more misleadingly, very often a quarter of the students even reported their salaries to begin with. And law schools know very well that the students who earn the highest salaries are very happy to report their salaries, so they have a nearly 100% reporting rate. But students with very low-paying jobs, most of them do not report their salaries. So because of the selective reporting and category construction, law schools truthfully, again, advertise sky-high employment rates and sky-high salaries when the underlying reality of the employment in the class was much, much worse than that.
And at the risk of sounding flip here, I mean, the truth is that 90% of law school graduates graduate in the bottom 90% of their class.
That's right. That's right. And the best paying legal positions out of law school are corporate law positions. And when you're up in the top 10, 15 law schools, a significant proportion, maybe half, a bit under half of students land these positions. But outside of those top law schools, and very quickly outside about the top 25, at most law schools, maybe 1 out of 10 students get these jobs. And everyone else lands in the bottom half. The legal employment market is quite odd. It's called a bimodal distribution. And what it means is that you have two earnings clusters, one high-end earning cluster that earns around $140,000, $160,000. But that, again, overall is about 10% of the graduates nationwide. The bulk of graduates land in an earnings cluster that basically centers around $40,000 to $60,000.
Which is not so different, excuse me for interrupting, from what a new teacher with a master's degree might earn.
That's right, except that the law student spent $150,000 to $200,000 in 3 years to get those earnings. And more importantly, those earnings are not enough to manage the monthly payments on the average debt. The average debt of graduates last year was above $100,000. Now, the average debt of graduates from private law schools was $125,000. So the median salary for 2011 was $60,000. If you earn $60,000, and that's the median salary, so that's half of the people who graduated, you can't make the monthly payments on the average debt. So that's a fundamental sign of the what I call the broken economics of legal education.
There are those who say, well, the term for new graduates to find employment should be longer than the current 9 months after graduation. What's your response to that?
Well, every year we have 40-plus thousand graduates coming out of law school. So the time period at which the employment poll is taken is in February. So I gave you the numbers for 2011. We don't have the numbers for 2012 yet. But what happens is if you don't have a job within 9 months after graduation, 2 or 3 months later, a new graduating class will be out for these graduates to compete with. And that makes it all the more difficult. And you've been stale, you haven't been working in a legal context, and now you're competing with another 40,000 graduates.
Brian Z. Tamanaha is my guest. He's William Gardner Hammond, Professor of Law at the Washington University School of Law. We're talking this hour about his new book, Failing Law Schools. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Z. Tamanaha. He's William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law and author of the new book, Failing Law Schools. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Brian, I want to talk about some of the reasons it costs so much to go to law school. For one thing, every student obviously wants to attend an accredited program, and it's the American Bar Association, the ABA, that's in charge of granting or denying those accreditations?
Yes, the American Bar Association, since the big, essentially the 1920s, has in place accreditation standards. And as I detail in the book, these accreditation standards were actually prompted by and then ultimately drafted and promulgated by legal educators who wanted to lift up the standards for law schools. Prior to, at the end of the 19th century, there were all kinds of programs and there were no particular rules, and schools did whatever they wanted. And the idea was that they wanted to standardize legal education. There was a battle at the time that among legal educators as well as in the bar about what kinds of standards there should be. And the academics who ran the ABA section on legal education insisted on law schools becoming academic institutions. This is important because prior to that time, law was seen more as a trade, and many people became lawyers by serving as apprentices in legal offices. So people on the other side of the debate held the view that law is not an academic subject and we should have law schools. They still agreed that students should be trained in law schools, but that the law schools should be oriented on teaching students the skills they needed to engage in legal practice. Well, the academics won out in the debate, and a set of academic-related standards were enacted and now enforced by the ABA. By academic, what I mean is that they had special provisions written into the standards that require, for example, that the bulk of the full-time faculty be tenured or on tenure-track positions, that faculty be provided with ample time for research, and be provided with research leaves, be provided with research funding. Now, these provisions aren't necessary if your goal is to train students to be lawyers, and unaccredited schools, or there are five states that don't require graduation from an ABA-accredited school. They are accredited by regional bodies, and those schools don't operate the same way. They don't have faculty who are primarily academic, so as a result, their tuition is much cheaper.
And let's talk about the salaries that are paid to law professors, and here is where I'm sure that you have ruffled a few feathers in the mm-hmm. faculty lounge. You essentially argue that law professors, if they choose to, can sort of skate by and not do as much work as their colleagues in, say, the biology department.
Well, I don't know about how much professors in any other department work. What I focused on was really how much we work.
Okay.
And in a chapter, I detail that over the course of a century, but in particular in the last 25 years, law professors have systematically ratcheted down their teaching loads and ratcheted up their salaries. So for the bulk of the 20th century, the average teaching load for law professors across the country was about 14, 15, 16 credits. And now the average load is below 12 credits. By 12 credits, I mean over a year. So that essentially means we teach 6 hours each semester. Now, for the bulk of the 20th century, it was 3 or 4 credits more than that, which is essentially one more course. Elite law professors today teach between 8 and 10 credits, which is 4 or 5 hours a week each semester. So what we've done over time is bring down our teaching load through various action. And meanwhile, at the same time, we've brought up our salaries to the point where we're now paid, the average law professor earns more than the top quartile of earnings for salaried lawyers. Now, by comparison to regular university professors, I think professors at research universities have similar teaching loads than ours. The difference is that this is across all law schools. And in terms of salaries, there are many statistics that show that law professors earn a significant amount more than other professors in the university. I don't remember the specific figure, but something like $50,000 more than English professors, for example, on average. And I believe some of these numbers actually underreport how much we earn, because we also get summer research grants. Law professors also enjoy subsidized housing and other forms of perks. Now, again, many, many professors at elite universities, I'm not talking about law schools, have the same teaching load and earn well, but law professors typically earn this across the board.
Well, law professors, I would imagine, would argue with you and say, yes, but if I were working in a top corporate firm, I'd be making twice what I'm taking home, sacrificing to be a university law professor.
That's right, and that's the argument that's been given, again, for 100 years. The problem with that argument is that many people who are law professors don't want to be corporate lawyers, and actually, many of them don't have the skills to do it. It's not easy to be a corporate law partner, and so we can talk about I could have made $1 million, but it's not clear that it's true. In addition, in the past generations, law schools have become more and more academic to the point that in recent years, a significant number of new law professors have PhDs and no legal experience at all. Now, these people weren't going to be corporate lawyers, so they're not giving up any income. In fact, we have people who would earn much less in a history department, boosting their pay by getting teaching jobs in law schools. So, yes, it is indeed true that law professors say that, and we've been saying it for a long time. I think the telling evidence against that is precisely the fact that we have every year hundreds of people applying to become law professors, many of them leaving corporate legal practices. And the reason for that is simply that corporate law work is very tough. Young associates bill over 2,000 hours a year, and law professors can work as much as they want. We have freedom of our time, and on a per hourly basis, we earn much more than corporate lawyers do.
So before we open this up to questions from our audience, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the system of sort of ranking law schools in this country. And the big famous evaluator is this magazine, U.S. News and World Report.
Right. Well, this is a big part of what's driving kind of economic craziness within law schools, and that's competition over the U.S. News ranking. And U.S. News uses a number of metrics to rank law schools, and what law schools have done is become what these metrics measure. So U.S. News weighs LSAT median and GPA, so law schools do everything they can to boost their LSAT median and GPA. 25% of the poll is based upon surveys sent out to academics to rank. It's called reputation rating among academics. Another 15% is a reputation rating among law firms. Another factor takes into consideration, a very small factor, the bar passage rate. Another one factor is expenditure per student. So what law schools have done is break down each one of these numbers and then done everything they can to boost their score on each of these metrics. And this is a part of what got us into an arms race. We're all competing for ranking and doing whatever we can, including spending all sorts of money on each one of these in each one of these categories to boost up our rate.
Yeah, I'm no expert here, but it seems like bar passage rate should be maybe the number one criteria.
Yes, it's not. It's actually, I think it's 2%. I don't think it's a very large number, but yes, that's not counted very heavily. But one factor that is counted is overall employment rate, and that's what's encouraged our employment shenanigans.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Anthony calling from Arlington. Hi, Anthony.
Hi. Thank you for doing this.
Sure.
I had a question. I'm an LSAT tutor in DFW, and I, you know, sometimes talk to my students about going to law school and whether or not it's the right choice. And just as a general guideline, I tell them that if they're going to maybe a top 14 school, they can pay some money for it. And then if it's a top 50 school, then they want to make sure that they're going for free, or at least a large scholarship. I was wondering what you thought about that. And also, I wanted to forward, like, law school transparency, which supposedly only has numbers that the students report and they're not manipulated by the law school. And toplawschools.com, too, also constantly talks about the economy, and it seems to be a really good resource for people who are thinking about law school.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Yes. Law School Transparency is a very good resource for information on individual law schools. And they get that, they collect their information from a variety of sources, mainly the ABA and the U.S. and U.S. News and World Report. They get the underlying employment data from these sources. What's good about that website is they actually break it down in a comprehensible way and do a school-by-school profile. And actually, I encourage anyone thinking about law school or in considering different options for law school to take a very close look at the Law School Transparency website. I don't think top law schools is as good in that sense. I mean, there are many people on there giving their opinions and so forth, and it's interesting to listen to that. But the Law School Transparency site is data-driven. Let me also emphasize one thing. For anyone looking seriously into law school, the key, or to at particular law schools, the key number to focus in on is the number of graduates at any given school that obtain, or the percentage that obtain full-time permanent jobs upon graduation. And the reason for that is that law schools, despite changes in the reporting standards, are still able to fill in all kinds of fluff. But that's the one, it's called the bar passage required category. That's the one category that's more or less fixed in a way that's not open to interpretation and therefore is comparable across law schools. And ultimately, that's the main reason people go to law school. They want to be able to practice law. So they should focus in on that category. As far as your general advice, I think in general it's good advice as far as it goes. If you go to a top 14 law school, you have a fairly good chance of landing a corporate legal job to pay off the debt, whatever debt you acquire, you take on to attend law school. And outside, once you get outside the top 14, top 20, top 25, that number diminishes quite quickly, as I said earlier, to maybe 1 out of 10. A consideration I like to focus on is how much debt you expect a student expects to have upon graduation. Someone who has $50,000 in debt will be okay, even if they don't land a lawyer job. I mean, it will be difficult, but it will be okay. Someone with $100,000 in debt has to get a corporate legal position to pay that off. And the chances of getting that is something that these students thinking about law school have to think about very, very carefully. Now, I want to add one other factor, and that is the income-based repayment program. So there are ways to finance it, even if you don't land a corporate legal job. But there are many negatives attached to that program, and law schools today are pitching this program to students without warning them about the negative consequences of this program.
How does all of this debt that students graduate with affect where the students from these top universities that cost the very most in most cases, where they choose to practice and what they choose to practice? In other words, if you have $125,000 in debt, can you afford to be like the world's greatest immigration lawyer?
No. Many law students, unfortunately, go into law school thinking they'll engage in public interest work or immigration work to go with your suggestion. The problem is that the corporate legal jobs are given out in the fall of the second year. That's when students interview, and then they work at the firm after the second year, and they typically will get offers out of that second year summer job, and then they're all set. The public interest jobs are not given out until near graduation of the third year, if not after graduation. So someone who wants to do public interest work will take a very serious risk if they pass up a corporate legal job, assuming one is available to them, in the fall of the second year in the hope that in the third year they'll land a public interest job. And as a result of this risk, most students don't take it. They take the corporate law job, work as long as they can to bring their debt down, and then move on to do what they would like. The other problem is that public interest jobs are hard to find now. Legal Services Corporation just announced that it's going to cut more lawyers. A lot of state legal jobs have been cut in recent years owing to the economic situation. So there are very few of those jobs to be gotten. The one benefit of a public interest job, it's a very important benefit, is that in the income-based repayment program, graduates who obtain public service jobs have their monthly debt payments calculated in relation to their income. And at the end of 10 years, the remaining amount of their debt is canceled. So it's a terrific program. But as I said, the problem is twofold. One is that there are very few of these jobs, and they're extremely competitive. And the second is that these jobs are given out after corporate law jobs. So as a result of this dynamic, most everyone with a large loan goes for corporate law jobs and tries to get them. And again, let me repeat that only about 10% of law graduates nationwide are getting these jobs. So what we need to be thinking about are the 90% of the other students that aren't landing in these positions.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Margene on the line in Dallas. Hey, Margene.
Hi. I have a question concerning schools. Why in this economic environment, when we are graduating more law students than we can employ, has Texas now decided to start a new law school at the University of North Texas and also acquired one through Texas A&M University, which bought Texas Wesleyan? That seems just really economically a bad decision.
Well, I will say Brian is not an expert on the system here in North Texas, but maybe you can speak to, in a general sense, Brian, to why new law schools are being set up.
Well, there are actually a number of law schools coming in line in the next few years, not just the North Texas School of Law, but Cooley began a branch office in Florida. There is a law school coming online in Indiana, Indiana Tech, I believe it's called. Now, a number of these law schools were planned a few years back when it wasn't that obvious that the market was in a crunch. Although anyone who looked at the statistics would have realized that we already had an oversupply. But we've been opening up law schools for 20, 30 years. And people, I think universities see law schools as a prestigious institution to add. But in addition, they, at least previously, thought of law schools as cash cows. Those days are over.
My guest is Brian Z. Tamanaha. He's William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law. His new book is called Failing Law Schools. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Brian Z. Tamanaha is my guest. He's William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law and author of the new book, Failing Law Schools. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Brian, I did my undergraduate education at Texas Christian University. I feel like I got a good education, but what it really did was prepare me to learn to be a journalist on the job. I mean, is the goal of law school any different from that?
Law schools have been criticized, again, for a very long time for not adequately training lawyers, and there are a number of different concerns raised in relation to this. But one of the main problems is the best way to learn how to be a lawyer, how to practice law, is to actually be a lawyer, to actually become engaged in the practice of law. It's something you learn by doing. So what law schools can do at most is provide you with a general background of understanding of the law, areas of law, how to do research, how to write memos, how to draft contracts, and so forth. But you really learn what to do when you begin doing it, and there are many different practice settings. So law schools have long been criticized for failing to train students in a way that allows them to hit the ground running, and I think there's much truth to the complaint. The problem is it's not clear that we're capable of doing that. And again, going back to early in the century, the position taken by the bar, law schools wanted their graduates to be able to immediately take the bar, and they lobbied hard for that. But many practicing lawyers in the bar generally took the position that, no, you can go to law school for 2 years, apprentice for a year, and then sit for the bar. Now, ultimately, the law schools won out. But the complaints, the perennial complaints about us doing a poor job of training, I think actually bears witness to the wisdom of the position taken at the, by the bar at the beginning of the century.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Matt in Addison. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Chris, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A very interesting topic. I'm a lawyer of 20 years' experience, and I've had the chance to sort of be thinking about a lot of these issues as time has gone on, and my distance between myself and my education has passed a little bit further. One thing that Professor just mentioned, in fact, is this idea of an apprenticeship, which was originally proposed. As a lawyer who now has younger lawyers working for him, I think that would be very valuable. Beyond valuable, though, really, I think it's an inherent flaw in the system that you can go to law school and pass the bar and you have a very general license. You know, I could have never taken a single, for instance, criminal class in law school and passed the bar and purport to be a criminal lawyer. I think that's a system that does not work, and I think something more along the medical model might work better, with sort of an area of specialization where you sort of apprentice in for a while before you're certified.
What do you think, Brian?
Yes, I think that's generally correct. And I should add that the law schools in the 90s, mainly in 2000s, have really bulked up their clinical offerings. So we have a whole variety of these, some called internships and externships. But essentially what they represent is putting law students in practice settings. There are two problems with this. One is that still often they're inadequate. You don't get enough of an experience to count as a genuine apprenticeship. But the other problem is that they're very costly. The student-teacher ratio is basically one faculty member per 10 students, and that's very expensive to be able to run that. So as a result, many law schools don't have enough of these programs for every student to be able to get this experience. And again, there's a kind of oddity to it, because here, when we create clinics, we create artificial practice settings when these practice settings already exist outside in the world of legal practice. It's a real problem, and we made the wrong decision, I think, early on, and are now trying to make up for that through clinics. But clinics bring another major expense, and the expansion of clinics has also added to the expansion of faculty, which has been another factor contributing to the rise of tuition.
Do you have to be a tenured professor of law to teach a decent class to law students, or can you be a judge or a practicing attorney who gives an afternoon once a week and comes in and works with students?
In my view, there's no question you can be an excellent teacher as an experienced lawyer or judge, just as you can be a not very good teacher as a tenured professor of law. It's not really about that status in particular, but about your ability to teach. Now, law schools have taken the position that the bulk of the faculty, and this again is enforced by the ABA rules, or at least how the rules have been applied by legal educators, they require that the bulk of the faculty be tenure-track academics. And that's part of the problem that's also driving up costs.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Nicole is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great, great guest we have today. I'm thrilled that he's enlightening on a lot of things that I have suspected. I graduated from law school in Tulane, and I was always hearing that saying, the first year they work you to death, the first year they scare you to death, second year they work you to death, third year they bore you to death. When we talk about cost cutting and the cash cow tendencies towards universities to supplement with a JD program, could it be that the JD and the MBA, you know, MBA used to just be a one-year program. Back in the day, JD used to be a two-year.
Mm-hmm.
Is the addition of these extra years more of a way to siphon off more money? I don't see why it's a three-year program. And
well,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
Okay. I agree with you. And I talk about one of the chapters in the book is why law school's 3 years instead of two. And again, this was a choice made early in the century, and it was made by academic-oriented schools that wanted to impose the three-year standard. There were many law schools before the turn of the century, including many elite, particularly Southern elite law schools, that were only 2 years, and it worked fine. The problem is that the rules have been in place for a long time, and that would require a definite change to the ABA standards, and I would not rate the likelihood of that change high.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Sid calling from Albuquerque. Hi, Sid.
Hi. Thank you for the call. I have actually a couple comments. One being the issue of really having clinical experience. I practice as an attorney, and I'm fortunate enough to practice with a lawyer who's also a doctor. And he's always said that out of medical school, you got a lot of clinical experience in medical school so that when you were done, you could actually, you know, somewhat treat a patient and diagnose a patient, whereas when he graduated from law school, if, other than knowing where the courthouse was, you didn't really know much about how to litigate, and you kind of had to pick that up. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a push more to get more clinical experience, more practice experience in law school, maybe in the third year, maybe replace the entire third year with a whole kind of internship or clinical training.
Well, I make a proposal along these lines in the book, in addition to proposing that it be reduced to 2 years. The problem, again, with the way clinics are set up in law schools is that they're too expensive, so it has to be done in a different way, perhaps in partnership with public organizations like the Legal Services Corporation, in a way that allows students to get actual practice experience, but in a way that can have one professor supervising more than 10 students. And if we have the assistance of practicing attorneys in an office setting, it might be more financially feasible. Under the present arrangement, it would be very, very costly to expand clinical programs. And again, I want to emphasize the big problem here is that it costs too much as it is. And let me just put some numbers out there because I'm not sure many listeners know that. The most expensive law schools today are over a dozen law schools. Their tuition is over $50,000 a year.
Hmm.
And even the cheapest accredited law schools are about $35,000 or low 30s. And if you add living expense to that, it costs over $200,000 to attend law school today at the most expensive schools and over $150,000 at the least expensive accredited schools.
So there are scholarship opportunities available, often merit-based, but you really feel like this is really about shifting costs from one student to another.
That's right. This is a specific consequence related to U.S. News. As I mentioned earlier, law schools try to boost their LSAT and GPA median. So in the 1990s, the bulk of financial aid was distributed on a need basis to people from families that couldn't help them very much. But by the early 2000s, this had shifted so that the substantial bulk of financial aid is based on merit. And what merit means or meant was that anyone with an LSAT and GPA score above the median, because the median was what was measured, would get significant discounts, half, in some cases, a full discount. And anyone below the median LSAT and GPA at a given law school would essentially pay full fare. Now, there's a perverse aspect to this financing scheme, and as you described it, it's really a transfer of resources between students, or the bottom half of the class subsidizing the top. The perverse aspect to this is that students with the top credentials coming in often perform the best while in law school and therefore get the best paying jobs. So we set it up in a way that the students likely to earn the least are actually subsidizing the education of the students likely to earn the most. And this we did because of the rankings, and it's an indefensible system, but that's why we do it, and that's how we do it.
Is there any remedy for the fact that no matter how well you do, whether you finish first in your class or you know, 99th, the sort of name brand of your law school matters in terms of you getting a job?
No, I don't see any remedy for that in the sense that the legal profession has always been elitist-oriented. And again, I did a lot of historical research when writing this book, and this goes back to the very beginning. There are national schools, and then most schools are regional schools. And in both contexts, the eliteness of a law school matters a great deal and the opportunities coming out. And this has been in place for a very long time. But just to take a look at the current Supreme Court, where everyone attended Yale and Harvard. But this is also in the high the positions in the Justice Department, in the high corporate law positions. The same distribution is evident in that in corporate legal hiring, the top students from the top schools, or the top schools place by far the most students in corporate legal jobs. I don't see that changing at all.
And you actually think it's okay to sort of leave the elite schools and the systems they have set up as is, but make some reforms in the vast majority of schools that make up the rest?
No, I don't think it's okay. Specifically, I challenge the elite schools for having driven up tuition. As I argue in the book, that tuition's based, it's a prestige pricing market in which the prestige leaders set the price, and because they have gone up so quickly. For example, Yale's tuition has gone up by 24,000, I believe, in the last 11 years.
Wow.
And I argue that if Yale had only gone up by 14,000, then tuition nationwide at the most expensive schools today would be 40,000 instead of 50. And I suggest that professors at these elite institutions ought to consider the social consequences of raising tuition so quickly. And the reforms that I focus on, which are capping the federal student loan program, either capping it how much an individual student can borrow and how much a school can obtain in federal funding each year, those proposals will affect elite law schools directly. There are different aspects to my proposal, but I certainly don't say elite law schools can remain the same. I think their raising of tuition without any care or consideration has been a major driving factor in the rise of tuition nationwide.
Do you think undergrads considering going to law school really need to ask themselves if they want to be lawyers or if they want a couple more years in school and what they think is a guarantee of employment?
I think there's no question today that no one should attend law school unless they are dedicated to becoming a lawyer. The risk of having a poor outcome when attending law school today is very high. And by poor outcome, I mean two different possible poor outcomes. One is not getting a legal job at all. As I said, only 55% of the class of 2011 landed full-time jobs as lawyers. But the other poor outcome is that half of the people who did land lawyer jobs earned $60,000 or less. And that's not enough to pay make the monthly payments on a $100,000 loan. Now, there are ways to make it, and as I said, there's a government-sponsored loan program that helps. But many students will find themselves in very serious financial straits if they attend law school, and it's important for them to be aware of the numbers. That's why I want to go back to something earlier call-in person said, that take a look at the law school transparency website if you're considering a law school and examine what the salaries are, what the employment rate of full-time lawyer jobs was from that particular school, and then you can get a sense of the likelihood of this investment actually paying off.
Brian Z. Tamanaha is William Gardner Hammond Professor of Law at Washington University. His new book is called Failing Law Schools. Brian, really interesting hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free every day online at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.